You can run, but you really can't hide when you're just a few branches down the family tree from Cornelius the Commodore Vanderbilt. Wendy Burton has written a very funny memoir about her illustrious and highly dysfunctional family. It's called Dead End Gene Pool. She read a bit from the book when she came by to visit.
The former Margaret Livingston Partridge was listed in the Social Register of 1963 as Mrs. William A.M. Burton II, mother of three surviving sons and two grandchildren, member of several prominent clubs, and chatelaine of four impeccably located residences, as well as one yacht. The long list of her charitable and social affiliations conjured up a woman of ceaseless energy, but in truth, my grandmother was never happier than when recumbent. Before she faced her day in the ruthless jungle of Manhattan, my grandmother had her breakfast served to her in bed. At 7, the butler carried in the newspapers and a tray table set with starched floral Porto linens, white Limoges china, and a silver Hermes thermos of Colombian coffee. Finally, the gaunt Swiss housekeeper entered. "Good morning, Mrs. Burden," said Anne Rose in a voice that sounded like she was introducing tales from the crypt. She consulted the schedule she had typed out in quadruplicate. "You have a fitting for the Givenchy ball gown in half an hour, and then your usual hair appointment at the Sherry Netherland. Lunch is at Grand Rue with the director's wives. You have an appointment back here with the decorator to replace the carpet in the Hope Sound pool house, then tea with the head of the co-op committee to discuss updating the doormen's uniforms, then cocktails at the Modern, then back home for dinner with your guests." "Righto," said my grandmother cheerfully as she penciled in 28 down in the Times crossword. Like my mother, my grandmother had her own funny roster of words and expressions, and anyone else saying them would have sounded mental. She said things like, "Isn't she cunning, for isn't she cute?" or "jazzy and snappy, for good-looking." If you were having a good time, you were gay. My brother and I called her Gaga, because that's the name she herself came up with when Will was born, not knowing that before long it would prove to be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
By the time Wendy was born, the family had been diminished in a variety of ways. Their name was now Burden, and much more significantly, Wendy's father died while she was just a child.
I was 6, yes.
And it's one thing to say your father died when you were 6. He didn't just catch cold one weekend and die.
No, he didn't get hit by a car either, although that's what they told me for years and years. No, my father was, he had severe bipolarism, manic depression, whatever they wanted to call it. They didn't really have the know-how or the tools to deal with it then, and he killed himself when I was 6. He had attempted it earlier when he was at Milton Academy and spoke about it. I've learned this as I was researching the book. It almost seems like he was destined to do something along those lines.
And your life changed when he died, partly because your mother was so young and began searching for another life that basically didn't involve you.
No, she was the merry widow, and she took off pretty much right after my father died, and we had a nanny, Henrietta Sterling, who was a Scottish woman who I adored, and then we had a cook named Cassie Diggins, and they basically raised my two brothers and me when we were in Washington, D.C., but we spent huge amounts of time with my grandparents.
Your father's parents.
But yes, my father's parents, and they had actually tried to gain custody of us after my father's death and were unsuccessful, but they assumed financial ownership, so to speak, and we spent really the bulk of our time when we weren't in school. We were with our grandparents.
One assumes from the way you say that they must have cared deeply about you, and I'm not sure from the way you write about them that was entirely true.
Oh, I think they very much did care deeply about us. I know my grandfather had a problem with me. To say he was a misogynist is an understatement, but he cared about his son's children, and I think that was more the sentiment. And my grandmother loved us.
I remember a story from the book. You were riding in the limousine, I guess, with your grandfather and offered to light his cigarette, and he wouldn't even allow you to strike the match.
And it's almost funny now. I mean, my grandfather and I had a very difficult relationship, but my grandmother was always taking pictures. She had this brownie that she would whip out, and my grandfather would always say to me, "No, let's just have a picture with the boys." And so I was kind of used to it, and And I was incredibly badly behaved and precocious. So in a way, I don't blame him. But on my 21st birthday, they gave me like a big dinner. And he actually got up to make a toast and forgot my name, which is, I mean, it's funny, but it's not. I mean, he said, and so I make a toast to you, because he could not remember my name.
That's hard. that's beyond hard when you're a grandfather.
Yeah, but it was true to character. So it's not like it was an enormous surprise.
On the other hand, you lived with them. You say your grandmother loved you. You enjoyed being there. And they had wealth. They had an extraordinary place that you could live, not only in New York, but in Maine in the summer on Mount Desert, right?
And in Hope Sound, Florida, and a big weekend house in Westchester County. And I mean, it was great. The perks were amazing, and the real estate was phenomenal, and I loved the freedom. I mean, they basically let us just look after ourselves.
What was life like there? What did you do on a daily basis?
Just ran around like crazy. Annoyed the help. There was a lot of staff, and I think I spent probably 75% of my time playing tricks on them. When we were in Maine in the summer, we went to sailing class, and we had friends over. It was like summer camp, only there were no counselors. It was fantastic.
The way you write about those times, it sounds as though there were ups and downs. There were things that were hard to take. In fact, at one point, you talk about having discovered the Addams family, the character. What was your name? Wednesday?
Wednesday Addams, my alter ego, yes. I discovered the Addams family at a pretty early age because my grandparents were friends with Charlie Addams, and they had all his books. And in the back of their Fifth Avenue apartment, there was a long hallway that was lined with bookshelves. And on the bottom shelf were all the sort of cartoon books and picture books. And I just sat there for hours, and I read every single Addams family book. And I fell in love with the macabre nature and the ghoulishness. And I also recognized as the Addams family developed through Addams's books and sort of became more of a family, because they didn't start out that way, I recognized in them a family that was pretty tight-knit and a lot more tight-knit than mine. So I sort of assumed this Wednesday persona and really wanted to be her in a twisted way.
Yeah, you know, it's funny in a way. The way you talk about it, it's as though you became Wednesday in the hope that her bizarre behavior would rub off on you and you could be a little bizarre and it would make your family tighter.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm sure I wasn't smart enough to think that way at the time, but...
See, there's a picture on the front of the Dead End Gene Pool. Can you describe it for me and tell me what it's from?
It is a picture of my grandparents at a fancy dress ball, and my grandmother is the spirit of aviation. And I actually have that costume. That's a propeller on her head. And my grandfather is a sea monster, and the lights on the suit lit up. And then the house beneath is Florham, which was the house that my great-great-grandmother and her husband had in Madison, New Jersey. It's now Fairleigh Dickinson University.
And I see in the distance there two statues on the front portico, and I understand you have those?
I do. They're these two huge Italian marble lions, and they have been back and forth across the country with me four times. And yeah, they're in Portland, Oregon right now, looking a little bit strange in front of a shingled house. But
and so you'll sort of proudly pass on to your daughters the Vanderbilt and Burden legacy and the lions.
I will. And I'm a bit of a pack rat, probably because I've moved so much. So I have a lot of Vanderbilt Burden memorabilia. I think I could probably open a museum. My children they'll inherit it, or if they can do whatever they want with it. But I think it's important if people have things that are worth passing down, portraits or huge marble lions or whatever, that they offer them to their descendants, because it's nice to have a tangible thing of the past, of your history.
Wendy Burden's memoir is called Dead End Gene Pool.